Chapter 8. Future's Fate in Time. Part 3. An Odyssey's Guise. Prefatory Matters. Right then, shall we begin again? For the first time. Again. It does so seem that the so-called identity of the individual whose alleged responsibility for this charmingly hypothetical, yet awkwardly apocalyptic oversight being the subject of recent discursive odysseys is not shrouded in quite so much impenetrable mystical security and obscurity as certain previous assertions have been led to assume. But not to put too fine a point on it, listeners. The individual is, it may surprise you to learn, one whom your presently not quite so present interlocutor is in the habit of defining by means of the perpendicular pronoun. In short, listeners, it was I alone who was responsible for this negligence. At least that is what I believe to be the case. And oh, my scars and demons, mystical heathens and people called Stephen, we have a problem. In his dream, Ezra was walking through a dark, stuffy corridor. There were cracks in the walls either side, through which artificial light peeked and flickered. Immediately, Ezra noticed that it was difficult to breathe. There was an unmistakable smell of marijuana smoke in the atmosphere, mixed with tobacco, most likely for financial reasons. It was a smell that Ezra was more than acquainted with, even being as asthmatic as he was. But that was just it. Kaya had introduced him to the natural green wonder of the world more than 3 years previously, and so his lungs had become accustomed by now. Fear, it seemed, was what made Ezra's airwaves close up. Not smoke, not this kind of smoke anyway. He had been smoking for a couple of years at this point, having started soon after Kaya. On their 17th birthday, Kaya gifted him a Medwaka pipe, a small smoking pipe, long, thin, and narrow. Ezra's was crafted from bone, his sister said. Hers from marble. It was something Ezra always kept on him, in a protective case in the pocket of the left leg of his jeans, as it also doubled as a pen Ezra used on a daily basis to write notes, as he preferred to do them by hand. Ezra felt for it. Nothing. Again he breathed in, his throat double-clutched. What was he choking on? Dust? How filthy was this place? Ezra could see in the dim light that there was a door a few inches away on his left, and on his right a staircase leading down into total blackness. Ezra looked to his right, squinting. The staircase did not look stable. Muffled music sounded in the near distance. Suddenly he heard a hacking, coughing sound sourced from within the apartment to his left. You know that sound, said his restless inner voice. You'd know it anywhere. I mean, how many times have you had to hold back her hair and listen to that soundtrack? Conscious of his unfamiliar surroundings, Ezra said nothing in reply. The voice was right, of course. He did indeed know that sound, all too well. She had gone too far, again, and she needed his help, again. The coughing and hacking stopped. Ezra seemed to split from himself then. He was still out in the corridor and yet was also inside the dingy apartment, searching rooms frantically but silently. In the first room there was nothing, but in the second he spied a few pairs of legs jutting out from the shadow on the far side of the room, made visible by the moonlight. A leg moved. I really hope those are attached to at least something. In the corridor outside, Ezra stared at the staircase, unable seemingly to take his eyes from it. Inside, he found a light switch and pressed it. Nothing. Bathroom, said the voice. You need to find the bathroom. The coughing started up again. Ezra almost tripped over his sister in the darkness, just managing to blindly grab the doorframe. Kaya was lying over the threshold on her side, unconscious but breathing. Even when she was over her limit, Kaya knew to always fall sideways if possible. Tongues can be useful but also deadly, was one of the things she liked to say. She herself, no doubt, had been given the pleasure of experiencing first and second hand the negative side of chemical dependency many times over. Ezra dragged his sister further out into the carpeted hallway. The smell coming from the bathroom was a sign it would have been difficult to get a strong foothold on a tiled floor in order to lift Kaya over his shoulder, and so he chose possible carpet burn over certain vomit. Kaya spent a lot of time at the gym and was in great shape. This made her heavier and therefore their exit from the apartment much slower. Ezra seemed to rejoin himself outside of the apartment, making the decision that it had been him who had entered and he had left a part of himself outside. Why had he done that? He didn't know. And right then he didn't care. At the top of the staircase, Ezra could feel cool air billowing from the exit below, and there seemed to be a light at the far end. He could just about hear rain. Ezra gulped. "Here we go then," he whispered, unsure as to whether he was addressing Kaya or himself. She hung over his shoulder like a pendulum of flesh and bone. He could hear vomit. Please God, let it be vomit. Just vomit, not blood. Oh God, not blood. "Calm," he told himself. "Just take it slow. One more step. Two more. Three." Ezra was on his third step when the cracking noise began to sound. On instinct, he took another step, knowing that staying still would do neither of them any good. But the next step down was even more unstable. Then immediately, he was falling. They both were, Ezra and Kaya, falling forever. The worst thing to Ezra's mind, however, despite the now apparent eternal sentence to descendants, was that he was the only one who was screaming. Now he seemed to be floating in a gigantic, vaulted space, lying flat as he had been before sleep had taken him, though his bed was no longer beneath him, and what he once perceived as his ceiling was no longer above him. To Ezra, the endless negative space he was staring into seemed infinite but also inexplicably enclosed. Dark, looming. He seemed to be wearing what he had been wearing in the car, minus the hoodie and t-shirt on his top half. It was cold. The kind of cold that makes you lose all hope of a pleasant day. "Oh God," Ezra groaned. "Not this. Not this again." For weeks he had been coming here, in his dreams. Somehow, no matter what the context, he always ended up here. Each time the darkness seemed to be closer to him. The vertical and horizontal slashes that covered most of his arms and torso, some healed, some not, began to throb in the biting cold. The scars glowed an ominous, almost patient red. "Dante," I whispered, through the color out of space. One of my only slightly contradictory aphorisms for dreamscape communication. "What do you want from me?" Ezra responded, deciding to speak aloud in my domain for the first time, despite his previous visits. In the past, he tended to opt for listening instead of pointlessly screaming like most others do. But Ezra Hennessy, like his sister, wasn't like most others. "I know who you are. What you are. I am your eyes in the dark. One moon circles." "My grandparents warned me about you." "Did they now? How terrible of them. It's time, Dante. You have to save her. You did it before. You can do it again." "What does that even mean? I don't know what you're talking about. Save who?" "I think that should be whom." "Fine. Save whom." But Ezra knew who I was referring to. "You must widen your gaze, Dante. You have the sight." Just then, my voice began to envelop the claustrophobic dreamscape. "All you need to do is close your eyes." "I don't understand." All at once, the scars on his upper body began to burn, brightly, angrily, so that in the darkness, all that could be seen through human eyes was blinding pain. Ezra began to scream. "Just close your eyes." It was his skull's sudden contact with the oak wood floor that managed to snap Ezra out of his nightmare. Was it a nightmare? Ezra wasn't sure. A part of him knew that his subconscious mind seemed to be expanding without his consent. Pathways seemed to be growing. That's how it felt, anyway, and it was fucking painful. Ezra sat up slowly and ran his hands through his hair. Post-nightmare sweat had taken hold of almost every inch of his body with a vengeance, and so every minor movement was a flash of disgust and agony. He could still feel the burn of flared-up scars on his upper body, a great deal of which he knew were previously healed. It seemed that they had opened up again. That was new. He didn't want to get up. Of course he didn't. But he knew he'd better before his father asked him to. Alexander seemed to find effervescent joy in waking Ezra from his slumber, and he wasn't sure he could deal with that. Not now. Plus, the rain had stopped, which meant there was no way he was getting back to sleep. "It wasn't sleep," I whispered. "You were percolating." "Thanks for the update, asshole," Ezra spat as he half-scrambled, half-staggered into the ensuite bathroom on nearly not their legs and stared hard into the mirror. His nose was running crimson on the left. He turned on the water, waited, soaked a small towel, and then began to dab at his nose. The blood had stained his shirt. He went to remove it, then hesitated. "Why do you stop?"
"I don't know,"
Ezra replied, addressing his restless inner voice out loud.
"Shut up,"
Ezra continued cleaning his nose. The voice jabbed at him again, and at the same time the scar's burning pain began to rise in intensity. I whispered, repeating Ezra's own inner question.
"Why do you stop? Afraid of what you might see? Wouldn't you be?"
Ezra said, now breaking eye contact with himself and searching the mirrored medicine cabinet for his medication. Nosebleeds were a common enough reaction to stressful and or traumatic creative responses. Not long till the headaches would set in. He decided to commence a hunt for a pair of shades. Both he and Kaya tended to experience a regular mixture of intermittent light sensitivity and vivid hallucinations, or what their parents, not least their medical mama, would call hallucinations. And so shades had been a way of both lessening what could potentially trigger these visions, i.e. natural light and reflective light, and, of course, hide from eye contact. This recurring issue meant that a pair was never far out of reach, and recalling his rushed departure from his last visit to the lake house, where he had torn his room apart searching for Kaya's medication, causing him to forget a few of his own essentials, he spied a pair that must have fallen down the side of his desk. No doubt he had thrust them aside in utter anxiety, along with the phone that usually sat on his desk when his sister had ended the call. Her last words to him being, "It's time to go. Again. For the first time. Again. For the first time. Again." His present thoughts echoed the memory. He knelt down to retrieve the shades, using the leg of his jeans to remove a couple of months' worth of collected dust, then rested them over his ears. The pain in his eyes began to dull, and Ezra allowed himself a small smile. It died as soon as he noticed the phone was off the hook, the receiver clearly breaking contact upon the impact with the ground. There was the anxiety again. How many calls to the house had been missed? His father had only recently purchased one of those new and improved answering machines for the lake house, maybe because he knew he was going to be spending a lot more time there in the near future. But Ezra doubted that if one of the house phones was off the hook, the goddamn answering machine was new and improved enough to kick into life regardless. Maybe all that people heard when they picked up the phone to reach out to the Hennessy family during this difficult time was a dead fucking line? Ezra placed the cradle back on the top of his desk. He held the receiver in his right hand, poised to place it back down. He began to sweat again. Just then, a post-rainfall sun began to peek its way through the clouds, finding the window just to the right of Ezra's desk and streaming further through it. And this, to me at least, listeners, seemed to be prime time for a little bit of projection, as I had yet to form a lake house threshold.
"You know, it's much nicer when I can't see you," Ezra said, the phone's receiver still clutched in his hand.
"Don't blame me. It was your grandmother's idea."
"I don't need your help."
"You sure about that? You don't look so good."
"Well, what do you expect?"
"It depends on what year it is."
"Don't you know?"
Ezra asked, his right hand lowered as I entered the Neverlight, temporarily eclipsing Earth's far more honest sun. "It's not an exact science, dear. And I may have slightly eyeballed the latest dreamscape coordinates. Just wanted to follow up, so to speak. Need to make sure my instructions were at least contextually accurate."
"June, 1991.
"Ugh. What does that mean?"
"You'll know in about a year.
I haven't got long."
"Are you gonna put that phone down, or are you just gonna keep standing there?"
"I'm happy standing here."
"Because you know what's going to happen as soon as you put it down?"
"Yes."
"And what is that, Dante?"
"It'll be the cops, saying they found Kaya in a gutter somewhere and they need me to come and identify her body. Or maybe she got arrested for possession and needs me to post bail again." Ezra's grip on the receiver began to tighten. His palms were clammy.
"No, those are two of the many possible results. I asked you what's going to happen. Try not to get ahead of yourself.
Or maybe it's my tutor asking me why the hell I'm not in class." Ezra was breathing heavily. His legs began to shake, almost as if they may buckle beneath him at any moment.
"He gave you time off, doofus."
"Negative reinforcement sometimes helps."
"Did he, though?"
"What if I imagine that too?
What if that whole phone call was just another displaced memory? Or fantasy? How the hell am I supposed to tell the fucking difference? The sun outside began to die behind the clouds. Dante, focus. I know it's hard, but I need you to focus. Just think, become, and answer me. What is going to happen? Leave me alone! Ezra spat, saliva flying from his mouth. He slammed down the receiver in total rage, with a deafening crack that sounded cacophonously loud in the quiet room and caused his shades to catapult straight forward and into his family picture wall. His peripheral vision just had time to catch my projection retreat into the shadow, the sun having once again grown cowardly. The receiver in the cradle became one for the first time in months.
You all right up there?
His father's voice from downstairs. Ezra, who had near enough slammed his head down on the desk along with the phone cradle, perhaps trying to thwack the visions out of his head to no avail, was about to bellow down into the desk loud enough for his father to hear that he was fine. But before he could get the words out, the phone on his desk began to ring.
Don't bother,
Alex called.
I'll get it.
There was a pause, and for Ezra, that pause seemed to last forever. Finally, his father broke the silence.
It's work. I might be a while. Dinner will be out soon, okay?
Ezra replied with the last word of his father's sentence, minus the upward inflection at the end, and leaned back on his chair, rubbing his eyes incessantly.
Breathe, I told him. Just breathe. Take your meds and breathe. The more you project your insecurities, the more it is likely they will come back to haunt you. You are haunting me. I prefer the term teaching. Some would say inspiring.
Oh, would they? Well, that's great. I feel so enlightened right now.
Get a hold of yourself, Dante, and answer my question.
The fucking phone rang. That's what happened.
Exactly. You see? Baby steps. A ringing phone might as well be an analogy for a fluctuating point in time. The possibilities are endless. Do you see?
Ezra ceased the incessant rubbing of his eyes. I could sense a spark of newfound clarity within him. It was faint, but there nonetheless.
Like I said, you have the sight, Dante. And if you'll let me, I can teach you how to use it.
His head ached. His stomach growled like a wounded tiger. The visions, premonitions, and apparitions that had been plaguing the Hennessy twins for as long as they could remember always left a lingering feeling of physical emptiness in their wake. Food was something that comforted Ezra, and so, as he headed downstairs, shades now covering his eyes once again, that was what he attempted to focus on, rather than the thousands of lingering questions in his head. They buzzed around up there like ghostly flies, still attempting to flee from the harsh, guided hands of fate. The comforting smell of his father's home cooking hit him halfway down the staircase. Thanks to his stomach, that distracted him until the meal was over. Sausage, mashed potatoes, and gravy. It never failed to lift Ezra's spirits. Alex August was still on the phone, having served up only one of the two portions and placed it on the dining table before retiring to his private study. Ezra preferred to eat alone anyhow. With every mouthful, his mind grew quieter. It was like his negative thoughts, at least the auditory ones, were feeding on the food he consumed instead of Ezra himself. He decided that this weekend maybe wouldn't be so bad. How was he supposed to support Kaya, or his mother, when he was falling apart himself?
You're happy enough with your grandparents,
said the restless voice, now slow and sleepy, satisfied and yet still curious.
Why didn't you just stay with them? You would have been closer to Kaya, wouldn't you?
Maybe, Ezra said aloud.
So why'd you leave? You must have had a reason.
Do I need a reason? Ezra was arguing with himself now. I myself was staying quiet, merely listening.
You felt sorry for him, didn't you?
The restless voice teased. I did not. Behind him, he could hear Alex August's impromptu conference call escalate from conversational to heated remonstration. He could almost feel... No, he could feel his father's rage-popping veins under his skin. Ezra shivered. No doubt the office had fallen to pieces without him.
You know he's gonna let you down, right? The anger is always just for show.
Shut up. Ezra stood, heading for the door that led out into the lake house's backyard, from which Lake Ontario could be seen if you climbed onto the shed roof and peeked over the trees to the north. And Ezra decided that that was just what he needed to clear his head. That and the eternally necessary, since 1989 at least, after-dinner cigarette. He would have preferred something stronger than tobacco, but he didn't want to give his father any ammunition to complain, and was too sleepy from his meal to bother retrieving his stash from his room. Chesterfield it would have to be. He made it all the way down to the garden shed,
poised to begin the climb when he realized he, of course, did not have his lighter. The shed had a partially sheltered veranda constructed from corrugated plastic on the upper half for shelter and wood on the bottom half in the form of support beams. The same wood that was used to build the shed itself. He noticed a box of matches nestled on the window ledge above the hanging baskets which Ezra noticed were in dire need of replacing. Thanks to the crappy, corrugated catastrophe that was the veranda's shelter, the matches inside the box were soaking wet. He knelt down by a large, dripping gas bottle that sat beside the shed entrance and began to strike some of the dry wood below while also loosening the seal on the gas bottle, the Chesterfield hanging from his mouth. He listened intently to the low, hissing sound.
"Why do you come here?" the restless voice asked again. Ezra ignored it, but I didn't. "Maybe you just wanted peace, Dante," I whispered. "Just peace for you and for the rest of your human-flavored beans."
"Did you seriously just say human-flavored beans?
Are you seriously trying to light a cigarette with a wet match in a propane tank?"
"Maybe."
"Bad idea."
"You're a bad idea," Ezra snapped. The force of his words caused the cigarette to fly from his mouth, hitting the shed's decking below and trapping itself precariously between where the planks of wood came together.
"God damn it!"
He pulled another cigarette from the pack. Just then the sun broke once again through the looming clouds, giving me a wide enough window to thrust my hand through the flare and click a flame to life in between my fingers. Ezra's brow furrowed as he sucked on the other end of the cigarette, the fresh smoke escaping his mouth and nose, like a frost giant burping out the ghost of a newborn angel. The sun disappeared along with my hand. Ezra exhaled, dropping the match. He retightened the propane tank with his right hand, holding the Chesterfield in his left. Thunder clapped above his head. He watched the rain pass through the smoke as it swirled like a micro maelstrom. He removed his shades and focused his eyes, zooming in on the individual droplets of rain. It was like they represented all the possibilities that could come from his father's phone call, and he was trying to fill his head with harmless alternatives to the overriding premonition in his brain. He stepped out into the rain, the cigarette now back in his mouth, puffing steadily.
"Rain bleeds, Dante. Eyes bleed. Ears bleed, phones bleed, brains bleed, gods bleed.
Alright, jeez,
things bleed, I get it."
He paused.
"Gods don't bleed, don't they?
Well, you don't bleed, do you?
What do you think?"
What exactly is the point in all these questions? I was about to answer, but then I felt the tap on my shoulder. Not many people dared to interrupt me during an extended training session. There was a short list of people I wouldn't immediately murder for doing so. On this occasion, however, that thankfully wasn't necessary.
"Go about your business. Don't mind me."
"Wait, what? I thought..."
No. "You need time alone. I can give you that, relatively speaking, and so I shall. Just exist, please. You and your sister exist, please."
Minutes later, he found a fresh cigarette in his hand. Through the smoke, he saw a cowboy. Or rather, another kind of being in the guise of a cowboy. A human face, but the ears of a wolf. The look suited the man, strangely. He had a downturned mouth, contorted into a grim expression which Ezra found was already growing on him. He didn't understand what he was seeing, and even though the man was armed, he saw no harm in him. He drew his gun, like a performer at a gun show, and twirled it around on his pointer finger before holstering it again. He looked at Ezra, dead in the eye, and said,
"Cities are for fools. You know that, right, boy?"
"Sure," Ezra said, again puffing on his cigarette and setting his mind on another. A few seconds passed, the man's gaze unbroken.
"You a fool, boy?"
"I have no idea." "Probably."
"I do,"
the cowboy said. He planted himself on the slabs that bordered the grass opposite the veranda of the shed.
"You ain't no fool, but your daddy, he's a city boy. He's a fool. All he is a means to an end, right?"
"What are you talking about?"
"You and your sister are special. Two of a kind. You see things others don't, and you're going to be seeing a lot more things come the day of awakening."
The day of awakening? Above, the thunder clapped again. All at once, he remembered his dream, almost as if the cowboy's most recent words had caused a reverberation around his skull. The cowboy sat, admiring his guns. Ezra thought about pressing the Day of Awakening thing, but he decided against it. Instead, he said, "Where are you from?" The cowboy laughed, a vicious, throaty cackle.
"Where do I come from?"
Then he stopped laughing.
"Where do you come from?"
"A fool, apparently."
"I like you, boy. Oh, damn, we're in good hands. Should all go as planned." "Exactly."
He stopped again, almost freezing in a tableau of clenched delight.
"You come from a fool, but you ain't no fool. I mean, you have no idea who I am, but your father sure as hell does, or would be the one most likely to recognize me, other than your mama, of course. If your daddy could see me, which he can't because he's a fool, he would have a lot to say.
Scream, in fact.
He'd kiss my boots in goddamn gratitude, or shoot me in the face. To be honest, I ain't sure which. You should listen to your Uncle Red. He saved my life more than once. Funny looking. He's a funny looking guy, but we all are, on the inside. He just paints his inner self on the outside."
And then he was gone. Ezra just stood there, alone. Finally alone. Was it the first time he had spoken directly to a hallucination? Of course not. Was it the first time his hallucinations had given him information that he hadn't acquired by other means? Maybe. It was possible. His hallucinations seemed to use his brain like a search engine, pulling up pieces of information and memories that could be incredibly useful, such as a Star Trek-based hallucination that triggered a memory technique that could become useful in exam conditions. Sometimes all it would take was a gesture of confidence from Ezra's incarnations of often fictional characters. It was conceivable that the cowboy he had just spoken to was an amalgamation of various Wild West characters that had made an impression on his memory over the years. But there was something about the scar on his left cheek, the way his woven ears wiggled in the rain, that had become sleet. Suddenly there was the sound of glass breaking from inside the house. Instead of breaking into an immediate run, Ezra stood still, then began to saunter, not knowing why, at least not yet. He pushed open the back door into the kitchen. The house was totally silent. The silence sounded low-pitched to Ezra, flat and odd. Through the glass door into his father's study, one of two in this house, he had always liked to spread himself around the place, he saw his father, sitting with his head in his hands. There were sweat patches under his arms. A glass vase was in pieces before him on the ground, one his mother had picked out, had said she liked the way the sun reflected off of it because it created rainbows on the walls. She had a thing for rainbows, mostly because they made her daughter smile. One of the few things, of late anyway. And now that was another thing gone. That alone made Ezra clench his fists. Fool, Ezra thought, loudly. No consideration. No nothing. Ezra finally broke the silence. "I'm guessing you're not staying." There was no question.
"Ezra, I'm sorry. I know this. Save it, Dad. I don't have time to drop you off at your grandparents' and get back to the office. I'll be back late tonight. You're gonna be okay here, right?"
"And by late tonight, you mean late tomorrow night, right?"
He trailed off, but didn't attempt to finish his sentence. He just sighed and began packing his things for work. In his ear, the cowboy whispered,
"Would you look at that? That damn fool let you down."
The cowboy spat at the damn fool's feet as he exited the study, passing Ezra, himself leaning against the wall. They made no eye contact. The gob hit the floor with a wet smack that made Ezra shudder, putting him in mind of a pancake being flipped on oil sourced from sliver. "Ew," Ezra exclaimed, his eyes locked to the floor. "What was that?" his father said, halfway to the front door. "Nothing. Just leave faster, please." Ezra heard the clacking of Alex August's heeled shoes against the wood floor, then the door creaking, then the latch clicking, then silence. Well, near silence.
"You know something,"
the cowboy said, now sitting where Ezra had been 40 minutes earlier. He had his legs up on the table, his heels grazing leftover mashed potato. His jeans were becoming stained with ketchup.
"I reckon your daddy would be the only guy to marry someone as beautiful and intelligent as your mother and not come out the other side even the slightest bit more interesting or emotionally aware."
To Ezra, it was weird hearing a cowboy speak of emotional awareness, given that he looked to be straight out of the 1800s Wild West.
"And don't you let this exterior fool you, boy. I'm all fluffy on the inside, so I've been told."
"You married?" It was a strange question, and even as he asked it, Ezra followed up his words with a questioning face.
"Why, I am indeed. Don't look so surprised. In fact, If it weren't for your Uncle Redgrin, I'd still be back in the Acatanian frontier fending off Leshens and Hydrophages.
This conversation was ridiculous. What was happening to him? The cowboy continued.
Of course, the trouble with Leshens is you have to use a combination of fire and telekinesis. Slow it down with a binding spell and then push it into place. Literally, push for the burn. Case closed.
Who the hell are you?
Your grandfather. I admit this attire is from my younger days, and my voice has changed a little bit due to me calling it quits on the cigarettes.
Just then, he cocked his head to look at his grandson, and Ezra could see, plain as day, the scar. It was him. It had to be. But why was he seeing him like this? In the lake house? Why hadn't he recognized him sooner?
Shouldn't you be with Grams? Ezra asked, attempting to steady his breathing.
I am. Right now, anyway. I'm also in the hospital wing of a mystical sanctuary being treated for serious stab wounds inflicted by one of my own. A lupine. An undercover operation your fool of a grandpa didn't see coming.
He paused, lowering his head as he stood. I was lucky, though.
And you're about to be lucky, too. It might not feel like that while it's happening. But all you need to do is focus and listen. The rest will come to you.
Okay, so undercover op aside, my grandfather is a cowboy wolf?
Nobody's ever put it like that before, but that don't much matter. Maybe it does, who knows?
You're really my grandfather? I mean, really?
You're Ma's pa.
What are you doing here? Then he was gone. Just like that, Ezra looked around the room, but there was no sign of him. The impression he had made with the heel of his boot in his leftover mashed potato had gone.
Okay, Ezra sighed, trying to get a hold of himself.
He tried to remember whether or not he had taken his meds. The memory decided reluctantly not to surface, and so he decided that work was the best distraction. It certainly worked for his parents. First, a book for inspiration.
It is said that in the final days of planet Earth, everyone had bad dreams. Ezra shut the book in frustration. Dreams. That's what it was all about. Dreams.
Return to dream to die, Ezra said, and almost sang.
He put his back against the nearest wall and slid down it, clutching the book, a cigarette between his fingers. He fumbled in his pocket for more smokes, then realized he was alone. His father had gone.
Ezra remembered hearing the sound of the explorer's ignition and the telltale crackling of wheels over gravel as Ezra's latest figment had slowly rose from his seat at the kitchen table, ketchup staining the back of his lower leg. Ezra dragged himself over to the spot where the cowboy had stood. There was a drop of ketchup on the floor, a perfect circle of red. Ezra used his pointer finger to pick it up, then put his finger to his tongue. The taste was familiar to Ezra, just not the one he was expecting. No, Ezra said. That's not right. He raised himself up slowly to the height of the table, then beyond, using the paperback on the floor to support himself before grabbing the table. The ketchup sat beside his unfinished plate of food. Picking up the bottle, he scraped his thumb on the rim of the lid where the fresh sauce leaked, as it always did when the thing had been previously used. He put his thumb in his mouth, tasting what he was hoping for. Even so, his confusion was growing.
Huh.
Without thinking, Ezra grabbed the fork still sitting beside his plate, dug the metal into the processed tomato-drenched carbs and stuffed them in his mouth.
Yup,
Ezra spat, the creamy mashed potato effortlessly sliding down his throat. He gulped. Definitely blood. A few seconds passed, then deciding it would be best to throw himself into the deep end in his current state rather than get lost in stimuli, he added, "Must have been a hell of a stab wound." With that, he dropped his fork and headed upstairs to his workspace.
He had all the inspiration he needed. And now, an Odyssey's Guys. People can sometimes know things at one level without being able to articulate what they know at another. Their thoughts can rise up from once ingrained muscle memory, moods, images, actions. An ability to understand all that may be contextually necessary prior to full comprehension in an articulated space. For contextual necessity and muscle memory
are both akin to a dream. Janus 3 Expanse, 2018. 1. At first, Kaya thought she must be dead. There was a red mist in her mind telling her that she probably was dead because she awoke free of pain and cold, nightmare sweat. Her body felt warm, content. And there was an inviting shiver on her shoulders that felt familiar in a way she couldn't yet identify. She didn't immediately open her eyes. Instead, she used all of her remaining senses to perform an immediate area investigation. As a child, on the rare occasions where her parents would visit her and her brother, they would often arrive late due to an often large workload. Kaya's mother particularly used to enter the room and do the personal parental confirmation that her strange children still remained in the world of the living and hadn't drifted somewhere more or perhaps less pleasant for too long. Often Kaya would pretend to be asleep. It was the only thing that seemed to make her mother stop for long enough, but it meant Kaya's ears had had large amounts of practice discerning between surrounding sounds. Currently, however, what she was hearing and seeing beyond her eyelids didn't seem to ring true in her sleepy brain of the reality that she last remembered falling asleep in. There were shapes in her eyes, shapes in her eyes made of light. It was like someone had taken a photo on a disposable camera in a dark room or under a duvet. Blinding, shapely light mingling with memories of pain and joy behind closed eyes. Eyes overshadowed by a freckled brow, currently furrowed by the past behind, inside her skull. Past mistakes. Past choices. Painful ones. Kaya honestly believed she had experienced past physical trauma at least partially comparable to childbirth, until the first proper contraction. After that, the only thing that got her through the next 190 was the thought that if she could survive this, she will have triumphed over true pain. She would be a warrior. That was before they had taken her baby away from her. That pain was insurmountable, indefinable, inexplicable. Just then another memory surfaced, one that her brain was telling her was slightly more recent and far more positive. Not just because it involved what the memory's helmsman had called level awesome narcotics, but because it had involved smiles. Smiles wide and true, so wide and so true that Kaya felt a smile creeping presently across her face. Her eyes still closed. Her body on another level felt numb. The smile faded when she realized what she had to do. What she had to do wasn't particularly complex. A mere simple movement was required. But the results of said movement would tell her whether or not the strange man with the long coat and shiny teeth and strangely inviting blackened lips in contrast to his striking albino features was all in her head. Just another one of her stories she had constructed for herself. A shelter to hide herself from the blatant clusterfuck that was her life. All she had to do was lift her left arm a few inches above her head, and she would know. Because if she was right to trust the strange feeling in her gut that had told her that the doctor was telling the truth, that she would wake up where he said she would, if she wanted to, if she believed it was possible, then at the very least she would no longer be handcuffed to her bed. She lifted her arm. The smile on her face returned. And that was when she finally opened her eyes. Stars. The shapes of light in her eyes were stars. Stars shone through glass. Transparent, airlock-sealed glass.
Online.
Came an abrupt surround sound voice. The glass beyond Kaya's eyes began to darken slightly, as if a tint had been painted over it in a space of a second. All but a specific section of the glass that itself remained highlighted. Her eyes refocused on her now free hand.
Please place left hand on designated area to confirm biometrics.
There was a pause, a loud one, before the automated voice finally said,
"Do so of your own free will."
That made Kaya laugh. "Free will," she said. "Just what have you gotten me into this time?" This was an internal question that seemed to receive no answer. A moment passed. "Breathe," said a voice. Another internal one she thought she recognized. "Just breathe and reach out." Kaya inhaled deeply. This was something that would usually cause a series of coughing fits or throw her into a vomiting cycle, thanks to her recent lung damage. Yet no cough seemed to escape her. No sickness in her stomach. Nothing. She did it again. And again. Frowning, Kaya reached out, her hand coming into contact with the tinted glass above her head.
"Biometrics confirmed,"
exclaimed what she assumed was the shipwide AI.
"Welcome, Kaya Hennessy."
Holy shit! Hi?
"Greetings, initiate."
Greetings,
You may call me House.
Kaya smiled. May I indeed?
You may.
Where am I? Kaya asked, and as the voice answered her, the screen in front of her eyes came to life, matching images to its words.
Currently you are aboard a Scimitar-class starfighter that itself is on a course bound for the lower echelon of the Janus III expanse. Jump to hyperspace in T-minus 9 minutes.
Hyperspace in 9 minutes? Kaya exclaimed, finally looking down to discover she was only wearing the blanket that was covering her. Guess I'd better get dressed then, huh?
Confirmed.
What's that now? Just then, she felt a small tickling at the back of her head, like a bug had just landed on the edge of her hairline. Kaya felt the back of her neck. There was nothing there.
Outfit ideas exchanged. Currently calibrating appropriate materials conforming to possible mission parameters.
Okay, Kaya said. She swung her legs over the side of the bed, much faster than she expected she would be capable, and finally stood on her own 2 feet for the first time in what felt like weeks, possibly months. She stretched her limbs and began wrapping what she now saw was a thin, grey blanket around her as she did so. All of that sounded a little too ominous for my liking. Ominous would be putting it mildly, my darling. Kaya turned herself swiftly to this new, yet familiar voice, a voice she heard with her ears unlike the other one. The one telling her to breathe and reach out, that had been internal. And this ship's AI that she had been making conversation with, unless Kaya was mistaken, seemed to be a mixture of both. Whoa! Kaya exclaimed, almost automatically. You scared the crap out of me! The smile, already on the dark pale face before her, widened further still. No, I didn't. Kaya relaxed into the portside cockpit position and regarded her. Liberator? Absconder? Just who or what was this man? Kaya absently began to twirl a lock of her hair with her left hand. Yeah, okay, you didn't. Startled, possibly. Well, that's a compliment coming from you. The man was leaning against one of the several blast door frames between her and what Kaya assumed was the cargo bay. Kaya eyed him carefully. You know me, but I've never met you. Oh, I wouldn't say that. The doctor straightened up and began making for the starboard cockpit position. He was no longer wearing the white lab coat he had been wearing on their first meeting. Instead, he was clad in a flight suit, extremely slim-fitting and matte black, with sections of armor covering sensitive areas, shoulders, knees, torso, midriff, etc. It suited him. Kaya could see that as clear as she could see the stars beyond the hull of this ship, but she could also somehow tell that the outfit he had on wasn't what he exactly enjoyed wearing. It was more for their current purposes, whatever the hell they were. Nice outfit, Kaya said, the words coming out far more disingenuously than she had intended. Right back at you, the doctor said, giving her a sideways glance. Where exactly is my hospital gown? I threw it into the sun. Well, a sun. You threw my hospital gown into the sun? Kaya repeated, slowly, ending with an upwards inflection. A sun, the doctor corrected. Not before extracting the useful fibers, of course. Which sun? Kaya asked. The doctor looked at her, his left eyebrow raised. She then seemed to register the doctor's follow-up statement, and this made her face screw up in confusion. I miss that, the doctor said under his breath. Kaya's eyes shot open. Miss what? She shook her head, attempting to focus. Right now, the important thing is for you to suit up. Don't take too long, though. We're on the clock. The outfit Kaya opted for, or rather it seemed her subconscious had opted for, consisted of a largely similar design to the doctor's flight suit, though it was slightly smaller, made to fit Kaya's body type and frame, matte black with various compartments for supplies and essentials, consumables, and a couple of leg holsters housing standard laser-based blasters. The ammo was composed of a combination of a certain type of stable, gyromagnetic energy-rich gases. Kaya's particular weapons contained power packs originally mined from Deglow clouds, highly dangerous when concentrated and yet surprisingly easy for Akatanian-born weapon engineers to cultivate and manipulate. Kaya stared at them in wonder, knowing that her brother would be losing his mind holding one of these things. Kaya, though, although transfixed, seemed, to the doc anyway, as he watched her, to be regarding the weapons with such a strange, expectant kind of recognition that he briefly wondered whether it would be enough. But it wasn't. Not quite. Lowering the blaster, Kaya said. So, you're gonna teach me how to use these things? The lightspeed gate seemed to mirror Kaya's childhood dreams. Dreams a child may have if they had drifted off watching a space odyssey showreel in the 1990s. She could almost swear that she had experienced this before, not once but many times, in different places and spaces. Yet here she was, in a region of space apparently millions of miles from Earth, taking control of a scimitar, again, for the first time, again. The doctor sat to her right,
gazing at her almost expectantly. This initially unnerved Kaya, but as the countdown to the jump to and through the lightspeed gate came to a tantalizing conclusion, the seconds ticking down in time with Kaya's healing heart, the newfound zeal pulsating through what she actually knew was her body, her brain, her soul, only burned brighter, burned harder. Kaya gripped the scimitar's flight controls. For a split second, it seemed that that same energy coursed not just through, but out of her. A familiar energy that seemed to grip the scimitar itself, flowing from Kaya's hand, or rather her heart, through the cockpit controls and all the way to the rear thrusters at the ship's stern. The rational part of her subconscious was also telling her that the power sourced from the lightspeed gate tended to make cruisers that lacked independent hyperspace capabilities feel, just prior to entry, like the ship had taken on its own personality, just for a brief period before being spat out into the colder outer regions, due to the shunts of the unstable Artron shockwaves. Then her subconscious stopped. There was a lumpy sound of thought, and then a question. Is muscle memory deja vu proof? Or in fact, proof of deja vu? They entered the gate. Take it on in, girl. Tunnel vision. Darkness on fire. At first, emanating no light. Chaos forming from residual order. Then suddenly entire suns powering whole solar systems passing Kaya's eyes at the speed of thought, nearly 3 trillion at a time. Kaya heard her own voice, her outer, more present self, calling out in confusion. What the fuck is happening right now? Hold her steady, Kaya, echoed a voice to her right. The her that she was in the hospital, that outer, present self, present of course according to that perspective, turned her head to look at the doctor. Behind him loomed the starboard porthole, illuminating the darkened sweat on his skin until the light was so bright that all Kaya was capable of seeing were his eyes. But it seemed that she couldn't just see his eyes, she could see into them, almost step through them and wander around his extensive optic nerves. Within she saw places, faces, moments she recognized, her moments, all these passed in the space of milliseconds, snippets. Pieces of pieces all pushed up against one another like dominoes, happily mangled and perfectly twisted into a highly specific and courageously wrong order. Memories. Some that Kaya knew she already had, and some that she knew, on some cognitive level, that she was yet to receive. In this seemingly timeless Neverlight, Kaya continued to stare. On a surface level, she could sense the lightspeed jump coming to an end, and the effect that the reflecting starlight was having on the doctor's eyes began to subside, 2 beacons of clarity slowly fading, almost in tandem with the lights of the passing solar system.
Darling,
Gryson exclaimed slowly, seeing the sparks of recognition in her eyes as she gazed. Gray? Gray? Kaya heard herself say. Is that you? Both of them seemed to reunite once more, in a frozen moment that seemed to melt away almost as soon as it had formed. Surroundings seemed to return to a relative normality, and just like the stars outside that had reappeared as distant individuals that had ceased to morph together, the revelations that Kaya regarded through the eyes of her liberator became vague, like the way you try to recall an intense dream upon waking. The only thing that seemed to remain was Kaya's inexplicably accurate muscle memory. As the ship exited hyperspace, their destination cascaded into view, as if the Scimitar battlecruiser, its edges sharpened by lasers to 2 curved edges no thicker than a molecule each, was an axe-shaped WMD and it could have cut the planet in 2. Another thought occurred to Kaya as the giant planet of red and silver drew closer. A planet that, until they exited hyperspace, Kaya truly believed only lived in her dreams. That there seemed to be a genuine lack of situational astonishment in the air. Kaya likened it to a reverse acid trip. Everything she was seeing, hearing, and feeling seemed normal to her, joyfully mundane in a way that made the corners of her mouth turn up as both her and the doctor prepared to enter the atmosphere. Another ritual that seemed to be based almost entirely on instinct. Queuing up the ship's autopilot for the planet-side sensor sweep, Kaya briefly wondered if all of this was just a dream. Maybe whatever the doctor had administered back in New York had caused some kind of mad hallucinogenic reaction. For all she knew, she could be eating through tubes right now. No, she dismissed the thought. She was a twin, after all. Her line of communication to her brother Ezra was always open, always live, and she could still feel him, which means she was awake, definitely awake. When twins have nightmares, they're usually alone. And anyway, This wasn't exactly a nightmare. Kaya's smile grew bigger as she remembered a quote that her brother had read to her while sitting at her bedside. Not long ago, Kaya supposed, and yet, so, so far from now.
The rituals last long after the reasons have been forgotten. Those words helped Kaya to fly.
The scimitar shuddered as Kaya pushed her through Akitania's acrid, oozed atmosphere, sourced from the ever-slowly disintegrating remnants of the Red Curtain's final call. A thick atmosphere stuck in a perpetual state of decay, causing storm after storm in the upper echelons. The sickened surroundings transformed the atmosphere's abrasions into a reddish-purple fire that captivated the ship's two occupants for a few further elongated seconds before the forward cockpit's transparasteel vantage portal gave way to that ever-reddening skyline, one filled with shining smoke being slowly pulled towards the source of the latest storm originating at the planet's equator. They had entered the planet on its south side, where the atmosphere was at its thinnest for ease of entry, flying low so as to avoid the planet-side sensors linked to the Guild of Vandalore's drone horde. Flying low, however, meant avoiding the spewing molten lava pits composed of the feuding volcano families of the old Southern Order. Kaya banked the scimitar to the right, left, and back again with an accurate, relaxed, and unrelentingly natural kind of precision, avoiding the vertical periodical beams of excess energy the families were formed to dispose of with an ease that rang true of dedicated time and practice. "Commencing cycle scan now," Gryson said. "What are we looking at here?" Kaya asked, staring at her display intently. She leveled the ship off past the last fire pits and engaged the autopilot, something she only did when she was unable to split her attention. She commenced a quick sweep of the surrounding skyline, and a ship-wide scan of the outer hull to check that nothing unfriendly had managed to attach itself during the atmospheric sensor blackout. "Coordinates coming your way, my dear, but looks like it's a moving target. Won't be much left of it if we don't work fast," Gryson said, sounding as present as he truly was, but also slightly distracted. Kaya looked at him, staring forward at his own personal HUD that sat at eye level with his cockpit position. His smile seemed to be ruled by an ever-deepening frown on his forehead. She was about to ask if everything was okay, but she was interrupted by the incessant beeping of the chrono on her gauntlet, one she realized she had initially started wearing to cover her self-inflicted, earthbound scars that she further realized would technically be relatively fresh, again, thanks to all of these damn displacements. Her most present self in her comparatively younger body, reliving something she could only half remember because events were now in flux. Kaya plugged the Corona's forwarded drop coordinates into the nav comp. In less than 3 seconds, the nav linked to one of Akitania's Southside geosynchronism satellites, most of which were parented by a designated guild commander, who fed the location back to the scimitar, along with what the guild believed to be the best desired course. Advice Kaya tended to readily ignore, opting only for the drop zone point itself and a proximity tracker. "Proximity reads, upper echelon 17A, Kaya muttered, subconsciously disengaging the autopilot and manually slowing the scimitar's ion engines. Gryson tapped a few keys on the starboard scanner control console. A beep sounded on his own chrono, which he did not immediately check. "Confirmed," he said, still staring forward, frowning. Kaya was pleased to see the smile return when he finally glanced at his left wrist, facing her once again. "Double confirmed," he exclaimed, springing up. The beeping on his chrono had ceased, but a couple of seconds and a flick of the wrist later, the communal heads-up display, which had previously only depicted Kaya's chosen route and proximity marker, now warped slightly on the upper right-hand corner and zoomed out to reveal a scaled-down layout of the general surrounding terrain, then zoomed in again on the middle right of the HUD's overlay to reveal upper echelon 17A, and more specifically, what lay beyond it. "It's a guild freighter, a big one, and it's being slowly pulled in to the center of the atmospheric storm," Kaya finished. "Great." There was a pause, then Gryson said, "It is, isn't it?" "Can you trace any kind of distress call?" Kaya glanced at her personal HUD as Gryson pulled a lever over his head. House's voice sounded.
"Autopilot re-engaged."
Kaya stared hard at her screen, tapping the holographic keys on the console's overlay, muscle memory ruling her actions all but completely. "It's difficult to say," she said. "The storm's making it difficult to get a reading, and the ion clouds aren't helping. You never said where you got these nav coordinates from." "I did some undercover work a while back.
managed to gain, shall we say, limited access to one of the guild's blacknet servers. These coordinates were the latest entries stored on that server, posted on the guild's bounty recovery section of the submission platform. I'd say we've got less than 30 minutes before others arrive. Was it an open contract, or did the guild want something specific recovered? That I don't know, but whatever's in there was bad enough that even the guild didn't want it stored on Akatania's northern side. Most likely by decree of the High Council. The south side is where they just drop the dregs and the forgotten to be slaughtered and the so-called unmentionables to wander the wildlands and, they hope, fall into an endless pit of screaming fire. The fact that the Council don't want it stored on Akatania's populated side doesn't make them benevolent. They just don't want to risk another scandal. Kaya was listening, but she couldn't take her eyes off of the overlay. As the scimitar drew closer to the Vandalore freighter, it began to detect the detail of the damage to the starship's hull and bring up the specifications on the communal display, snapping Gryson back to attention. The freighter was scorched black on all sides from what Hal suggested could have been an aerial assault. A recent one. How recent? Kaya asked.
Less than an hour.
More specific, please, House. Gryson snapped, sounding more urgent, which turned Kaya away from her personal display. Gryson had brought up a detailed analysis of the ship's burns.
Looks like we're a little late to the party, Kaya remarked, briefly checking the state of the autopilot in comparison to the quickening storm. It seemed stable.
48 minutes and 17 seconds. 18, 19, 20.
We get it, honey. Thanks, Kaya said. She now stood holding the back of Gryson's console chair. Doc, what's wrong?
These burns are a little too familiar. And familiarity is either very good or very bad in my experience.
Which way are you leaning right now? Gryson stared hard at his console.
According to this, these burns are from Scimitar-class cannon fire.
Kaya looked around her. There are more than one of these things?
She feels like one of a kind. She's more some of a kind.
We call this one the Taurus.
Taurus.
Kaya rolled the name around on her tongue, swallowing, deciding she liked how it tasted, not quite registering the significance of the name. What she did register was Gryson's precursor to his reveal of the name of this vessel. The doc had said, "We call this one the Taurus." Who's we? Kaya thought. Gryson continued typing. If he had registered her thoughts on any level, he didn't say so.
It also looks like the freighter has been hit by an ion cannon. The stabilizers haven't got long.
Gryson trailed off. Oh boy.
House, what's going on? Kaya asked, tentatively.
It seems that you are indeed a little late to the party. Observe.
Gryson and Kaya turned their attention back to the communal display as House flashed up a new blip on the Taurus's radar. Another scimitar, slicing through the clouds at a speed sourced from upper atmospheric re-entry. The ship was reading as damaged, but they didn't need their heads-up displays to work that out. The scimitar's hull was dented beyond belief, as if it had been pummeled by an asteroid field. Kaya noted the fact that scimitar's shapes were reminiscent of crescent moons. Kaya further imagined that each kind of scimitar was built for a specific purpose, and that depending on the equipment, the ships would also be comparable to moons in different stages of lunar development. Kaya's imagination had a tendency to be accurate. There was smoke pouring out of the various gashes in the crashing scimitar's body, ion particles melting away transparent steel. A sensor array dropped from the scimitar's underside and began its long journey down to the southern falls, probably never to be seen, heard from, or salvaged again.
It's the Daemon, Gryson exclaimed, his eyes wide.
Is that good or bad?
Kaya asked, biting at her gloved wrist, something she did when she was nervous.
Good and bad.
Keep going, Kaya prompted, retaking manual control of the Taurus as the sensors began to glitch out.
Good in the sense that it appears to have done a great deal of the job for us, and bad in the sense that it appears to be heading straight for the freighter's starboard observation deck.
What about the people inside?
Sensors are out, but if I had to guess, I'd say that there's at least two people in there. One to guide it in manually, the other to keep trajectory steady, and the engine's cool enough, which, given the state it's in, it's going to need.
You said that the freighter's stabilizers were damaged. If that thing hits its target, they'll go into freefall.
Not if we're fast, Gryson said. Move us in as close as you can.
You got it,
Kaya said, hyper-focusing on getting the distance between the Taurus and the freighter absolutely right. Thanks to the storm, the scimitar is having to keep its speed ramping up and its trajectory altered, which gives us, he glanced at his chrono,
Just about 3 minutes to take this ship in tow. Temporarily. The Taurus's relief support cables are strong, but they won't hold forever, and we have to use them to rappel down to the freighter, so keep the distance on the short side. But not so close that we'll have no time to react if this thing crashes.
Or explodes,
they both said in unison. Kaya smiled, and Gryson smiled back. Then her eye was once again caught by the burning scimitar hurtling closer and closer towards the freighter's starboard side with gathering speed. Then she said, "That ship is moving really fast." Gryson giggled and sat down at his starboard con position. Let's hope it's fast enough.
3. The collapsing scimitar-class starship looked somewhat like a 24th century double-edged sword of disintegrating honor. Or perhaps an alien waning moon, self-imploding from exhaustion. The interior atmosphere was thick with poison smoke sourced from multiple electrical fires, and thanks to the direction of the near-blinding, gale-forced wind, most of that fire's smoke was being strongly gusted in the direction of the cargo bay to the rear of the cockpit. Some of the blast doors separating the different areas of the crescent-shaped ship were jammed open, others were closed. The heat in the sweat-stained, blood-spattered cockpit was rising. The two occupants of the ship now had no choice but to cover their faces with tactical helmets that thankfully housed their own independent oxygen supply. They were also lucky in that their damaged emergency blast shielding had held on re-entry. If not, the masks alone wouldn't have been enough to protect their bodies from the dead cold of space, given that neither of their flight suits were airtight any longer. Chief amongst their current issues, and there were a fair few, was that neither of the two occupants of the ship were exactly where they desired to be. I'm not talking about the carnage of the multiple near-death experiences. In a way, these two mercenaries, if you wanted to call them that, masked as they were, lived for, thrived under the stress that carnage can inevitably bring. What I'm referring to on this occasion is their specific individual field expertise. Sure, both of them knew how to fly a starship, could master any ground or planet-side-based repulsor vehicle, and they were both capable of finding their way around most spacebound vehicles' engineering sections. However, one undoubtedly having a certain flair for engineering, and the other being one hell of a pilot, tends to suggest that, in an emergency situation such as this one, having the best pilot in the con position, and having the frightfully creative engineer busy at the stern, mending the inexorably overclocking power converter and disintegrating shield generator, well, that would be the ideal situation. Wouldn't you say, listeners? This, however, was not the ideal situation.
This is bad. I don't like this.
Hold it steady, Lieutenant.
Why don't you come up front and hold it steady, Captain?
I would, happily, if somebody hadn't blown one of the final few remaining port nacelles.
I told you to use coolant as we cleared the upper atmosphere, but no! You're all like, no need, LT. I can hold the piping together with my bare hands. Or mend it with the hammer that is my bare skull.
Is that bear spelt with an R-E or an A-R?
Either applies, you ham-fisted oaf.
Did you just call me a ham-fisted oaf?
Oh, honey, I've got some other words, but you're not gonna like them.
I majored in engineering at the Academy.
You told me you threatened the instructor with an experimental gas-based infiltration system.
Yes, an infiltration system I designed, and some factions still use today. It's called innovation, LT.
You say innovation, I say blackmail. Especially if you weren't lying when you let slip that you came close to pumping it directly into his personal meditation chamber.
I told you that was a joke.
God fucking damn it! Well, that's the starboard nacelle temperature gauge offline, so now we have to hope that the possible chain reaction doesn't incinerate us before this collision course is complete.
Very concise report, Lieutenant. Thank you.
What the hell are you doing back there?
Saving our asses.
Power redirection in progress.
How far are we?
That gauge is broken too.
Then let's hope this works.
Let's hope what works?
Power redirection complete. Stand by.
LT, activate autopilot.
Now?
Yes, now, Lieutenant. Unless you want to use some of this ship and a great deal of your face to smash through the viewing gallery of an enemy cargo ship.
It's jammed.
Then jam the flight controls and meet me in the cargo bay. Move!
The Lieutenant skittered through the uncharacteristically claustrophobic cockpit, aiming her body for the partially open blast doors that led out to the corridor giving way to the cargo bay. She looked around wildly, her teeth gritted invisibly under the helmet. The pressure on her teeth relaxed slightly when she noticed a burnt-out panel ripped from the wall by the force of the storm. It was narrow enough and thick enough to jam the controls in the forward position. The lieutenant grabbed at the panel, wincing and cursing at the heat from the nearing fire that cascaded from the source to her partially gloved hand. Then she was suddenly thrown to the side as the artificial gravity began oscillating between online and offline. She hit the wall with a thud, the protection on her shoulders and head taking most of the impact. She was still holding the panel, but the journey to the wall was enough to help her forget the pain. The lieutenant raised herself up as quickly as she could, turning the panel in her hand and scanning the engine with her visor, not before looking up for a split second to check the ship's trajectory was still correct. Beads of sweat trickled down her neck as she stared. The starboard turrets were still charging. Looks like their ion blasts hadn't been enough. She cursed herself for focusing all her fire on the freighter stabilizers. She had wasted an opportunity and created a bigger problem. In a matter of seconds, she used her considerable strength to wrap the narrow panel around the Daemon's portside altitude lever and pulled it towards her, rising the ship to as high a height as the one remaining engine would allow, then locked the banking controls in neutral. After another break in the artificial gravity, for which she used the jammed and locked gear lever for support against, the lieutenant saw her chance. She clung, vaulted, and skidded her way towards the door, making it look easy but not inspiring much inner self-confidence.
Starboard nacelle shut down in 1 minute 53 seconds.
The lieutenant thought quickly.
Computer, time till impact on collision course.
The lieutenant began to pray. Hard.
1 minute 59 seconds.
God fucking damn it!
She put a finger to her ear.
Cap, we have less than 2 minutes.
The comlink, the only thing remaining on that vessel still in working order, crackled in the lieutenant's left ear.
Thank you, sweetheart. I have ear holes.
There was another explosion, then another, and suddenly the ship jolted. The lieutenant had managed to make it through the first and second set of blast doors in the corridor, but as soon as the ship jolted, the second set of blast doors now mainly consisted of warped metal and so wouldn't budge. The oscillating gravity, having occurred again, caused the ship, and therefore the lieutenant, to go temporarily vertical, meaning that the only way she could stay at the same point she had been originally standing in the corridor, hopefully now out of the turret's blast range, was to cling to the second blast door's frame for dear life. It felt as if she were being tugged by some kind of magnet or some kind of strange organic tractor beam, but instead she knew it was due to the G-force from the ship's sudden but hopefully minor alteration in trajectory. The turret must have hit them. Suddenly she heard a throaty grunt of exertion above her as the captain, who had most likely also been sent vertical, but because he was on the ship's opposite side, heading for the cargo bay located near the middle, it sent him flying vertically down the corridor towards the lieutenant. Luckily, he was able to grab a blast door frame of his own on the way, giving the lieutenant time to lift herself through her own set of doors and use the strength in her feet and legs to push herself further through the corridor once her boots had cleared the door frame behind. She drew level with the captain's dangling armored leg and grabbed at it, instinctively, much to his complaint. Regardless, she was thankful for both of their considerable heights.
Why don't you climb yourself?
The captain spat.
Because there's only one doorway to go, and I have to try and activate this blast shield behind me so a bolt doesn't make it through and burn our asses off.
With that, the lieutenant used her right knee to destroy the glowing control panel to her right. This sent the door mechanism behind, or rather underneath them, into total shutdown, rendering the doors unusable and replacing the doorway with a glitching force field. The lieutenant breathed a short-lived sigh of relief.
Now move your ass.
The cargo bay was close now, so close that the concentrated smoke, unable to be released by the bay's extractors, was beginning to blind them, even with both their helmets' enhanced visual capabilities.
Almost there. Put your back into it.
Why don't you come up here and put your back into it and let me know how that goes?
Partially heeding his words, the lieutenant began to climb up the captain's back like a tentative spider, crossing its first web line after the loss of more than a few legs. She used his filter lock secured armor for support as she climbed, laterally choosing his belt as a foothold for extra support. Finally, she gripped his torso, tightly as they rose through the cargo bay doors. A similar control panel to the last one the lieutenant had destroyed, only this one was bigger, sat to their right. It was bigger because it was the heavy cargo bay door control panel. The lieutenant felt the crack of a smile on the side of her face when she saw that it was still operational, praising herself for ignoring the captain's protestations against running the cargo bay off an independent battery-based power source. It had been still luckily, and she could now see narrowly unscathed by the blasts, only just able to withstand. Then she thought about the fact that her decision to once again defy the captain's orders had possibly led to the seemingly random shield failure that had turned their sneak assault into a near retreat. With the shields up, the freighter wouldn't have stood a chance, especially given the near static position the storm was forcing the freighter to remain slightly suspended within. Plus, the daemon's ion cannon blasts had rendered the freighter's internal altitude controls near useless. The fact that the lower stabilizers, the only thing keeping the freighter afloat other than the atmospheric storm, were close to failing meant that the freighter itself had begun to descend, just enough for the daemon's remaining nacelle to itself be enough to keep their collision course on point. At least that's what both the captain and the lieutenant hoped, both independently and collectively. Alas, however, there wasn't quite enough power in the remaining nacelle to keep the daemon on course. The lieutenant had been more than focused on reaching the cargo bay in one piece than concerning herself with whether they actually hit the ship. In a way, she hoped they wouldn't. It had been much less painful. The captain, however, had prepared for this slight time difference. Thanks to the cargo bay's power source, the lieutenant was able to reactivate the artificial gravity around them. The cargo bay doors jammed shut, and they both hit the cargo bay floor face first.
What was with the power redirection?
The captain ignored her question.
Help me open the cargo bay hatch.
We're in shutdown. They won't open.
They will. Trust me. Just do it.
The lieutenant activated the hatch unlock sequence. The captain glanced intently at his chrono.
We have one shot at this. One.
One shot at what?
I redirected the power to the reinforced winch on the stabilizers and connected your independent power source to the outer altitude controls. When I say we're gonna clamp ourselves to that freighter and reel ourselves in.
Into the viewing gallery?
You got it.
The lieutenant checked her own chrono, ultimately astonished and impressed by the fact that, despite the ship's tumbling trajectory, they still remained at the right height and even the right angle to still make their final shots count. What came after that? Well, if they had the ability to cross that bridge, then they would. Right now, the first thing they had to do was build it. The crew members stood either side of the near-open cargo bay hatch, poised to activate the respective adjacent mechanisms that would send the outer stabilizer cables flying towards their target. The captain took a quick, deep breath.
We'll be upside down in 10 seconds, right side up in 20. I had to slow the altitude motion controls.
The lieutenant began to count down from 10. And that was the first time the captain had felt himself smile from anticipation in a good long time. They counted in unison.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4.
This is totally insane, Kaya whispered, as she made her way down the dingy corridor, deprived of fully functioning emergency lighting and just general surrounding power. The freighter felt dead, the only signs of life coming from the sparks due to broken, bent, and therefore unsurprisingly malfunctioning shipwide equipment. From control panels and doors to weapon caches and power cells, strewn all about like some kind of neglected treasure hoard of broken gadgets and warped mechanics and glitching electrical goods. A lot of it seemed fairly self-explanatory to Kaya, and she was in some ways thankful for the fact that, despite the milieu of mechanical masochism around her, she was able to find her way around without relying entirely on her new and improved eyewear. The doc had briefed her, briefly, on the various uses and attributes that the slick, matte black and quite simple-looking goggles possessed. Night vision, virtual reality augmentation for analytical purposes, and two independent atmospheric nanoshells, small enough to fit around her eyes and protect them from the air of the atmospheric storm. The reality augmentation aspect was what interested Kaya the most, but had been, in the end, the reason why Kaya was thankful for the sparking panels all about the ship's interior. Because having a virtual morphing reality right in front of her eyes reminded her a bit too much of bad trips. Especially when what the visuals were showing her were possible negative results of an acrobatic maneuver that would be inevitable if she didn't concentrate. It was too much of a stark similarity to her home life and her nightmares for her to re-experience and also currently triumph over in the midst of what was going on right now. This is totally insane, Kaya repeated. Just stay calm. You're doing great. His voice soothed her from her ear to her brain, but the burning questions were becoming too unbearable to keep inside. "I don't get why we had to split up," Kaya said, attempting to get used to the partial mask that also covered her mouth and nose. She readjusted it slightly. "We both came in the same way. Why not take the same route?"
"The observation hangar has quite a few entrances, from multiple heights. I mean, this freighter is big enough to hold a largish amount of cargo and a few small fighters or repulsors, so the hangar's not exactly small."
Kaya nodded to herself in the darkness, stepping over one or two deceased guild militia members. Guild troopers, or groupers, the ones that the doc had warned her about. Their armor was burned and their helmets cracked, some heads crushed entirely by heavy collapsed metal. Kaya knelt down and knocked on one of the dead body's armor plates with her gloved hands. She took a deep breath and reactivated her goggles' augmented analysis setting, expecting it this time. However, she was able to read the words as if her nose was just pressed up against the overlay of the torus, rather than her mind or her eyes playing tricks on her. Through the analysis, she discovered that the armor was constructed from a very cheap type of plastic that wouldn't even stop a dent from a plastic top of a milk carton. That was how she interpreted the streaming words running down her eyes, to her mind like useful, learned tears. Kaya stood and continued to make her way in the direction of the observation deck. A thought struck her then, one in the form of another burning question that Kaya supposed had been doused by the chaotic experience so far. She had been silent when inspecting the dead groupers, apparently so called in reference to the fact that they tend to hunt and attack in large groups, and in that state can put up a fight. However, individually they were much less of a threat. Kaya knew in the back of her mind that she really should be staying quiet. Regardless, she kept talking in hushed tones over the radio. "Hey Doc, you there?"
"Mostly."
"Can I, ask you a question?"
"Why stop now?"
"What exactly did you give me back in the hospital?" There was a pause, and then Gryson said,
"I'll tell you once you get through the next set of doors."
The space ahead of Kaya was dark. She lifted her hand to reactivate her goggles, but the doc, somehow aware of her movement, stopped her.
"Trust me, you won't need them."
"What do you mean?" Kaya queried. The doctor didn't answer her question. Instead, he said,
"Hang on, let me open the door for you."
In the next few seconds, what Kaya hadn't expected didn't seem to matter. When it occurred, referring back to it in the midst of the aftermath was like a blur. It was a blur to experience, to remember, and most of all, to look at. Firstly, the latest set of previously closed and seemingly blocked off blast doors shunted open. Blaster bolts fired. Time seemed to freeze. Beyond the bolts, Kaya could see a line of live groupers all pointing dust-covered rifles directly at Kaya. They had the whole width of the door span covered. Instinctively, Kaya moved her left hand over her right shoulder and her right hand to her left hip holster in a flash, gripping one of the knives sheathed on her back with her left and letting it fly towards one of the groupers, to the right of the door. The Acatanian steel effortlessly sliced through the humanoid's cranium, sending far right's head snapping back and cracking hard against the rear corridor wall. The quick movement Kaya had had to make forced her to also shift her head out of the way of the two orange rifle bolts. Burns stabbed into the damaged walls at Kaya's back, creating an audible, hissing, melting sound. Her left hand holster now free, she dove backwards, letting bolts fly as she felt herself doing the same. Even so, her airtime was only temporary. She hit the ground with a thud, grateful for an uncharacteristically smooth and clear surface below her. She felt the impact, but very little pain. Kaya used the momentum for her jump to slide across the floor upon impact, then used her free left hand to grab a fallen crate on her left side, turn to her front, and slide behind cover to her knees. She briefly smiled to herself as the blaster bolts melted a great deal of the crate's outer layer on the opposite side. She mouthed the words, "How the fuck?" before peeking around the side of her cover and firing off three more bolts at the legs of the four remaining troopers. Two of the three bolts took out both of the middle left grouper's shins simultaneously. The guard screamed in pain, crumpling to the floor and writhing. The remaining three groupers began to enter the corridor beyond, moving closer to Kaya's position. She could sense a lot of anger about them, fear giving way to, or perhaps overpowering anger, but causing carelessness. Kaya only had a matter of seconds, but that was longer than she had had before the first two bolts were fired, and it seemed that she had come this far. Quickly, she put her hand to her neck. Slight pain permeated the underside of her chin. It seemed that she hadn't been as fast as she thought. It was just a flesh wound, but it just as easily could have been fatal. She had been lucky. but she knew she couldn't rely on luck. She had come close to death too many times to believe in luck. Perhaps rather than luck, it was a lesson. The seconds passed as the sound of the footfalls increased. Kaya took a deep breath. Temporarily and urgently, Kaya pushed the frontal hand of fate aside and surrendered to her body. Slowly, she placed one gloved hand on one side of the crate and her other on the other side, getting a good grip. The footfalls slowed, the mechanical whine of reloading blasters sounding loud in Kaya's ears. Above, Kaya felt the leading grouper's gaze move over her bowed head. Time once again seemed to slow. Then, letting out a battle cry that she didn't know she had the vocal cords to muster, Kaya sprang into action, using what she felt in that moment was all the strength in her arms. Kaya lifted the heavy crate, bending her knees and pushing with all she could, jolting the partially melted but still incredibly unforgiving crate violently upwards. It came into rapid contact with the lead grouper's face, his helmet splitting open like a cashew nut. She jolted it so hard that either a hardened piece of plastic from his helmet or a particularly sharp piece of skull flew from the lead grouper's head like a deadly self-made shuriken and embedded itself in the neck of the grouper behind him on his left-hand side. The grouper on his right-hand side let out a yelp of fear, firing his rifle wildly in Kaya's direction. She was still holding her cover, the object itself feeling light as a feather thanks to the seemingly endless surging adrenaline. What Kaya couldn't see, however, was what was in the crate. More bolts were fired, some bouncing off the transparasteel that lined the skeleton of the crate, causing the bolt to deflect in whatever direction gravity or chance demanded, or merely burn more holes in the opposite side. Enough holes were made, however, that the blaster bolts were beginning to strike the crate's interior cargo. One final lucky shot, made by the last remaining grouper, made it through one of the melting chasms and ignited what turned out to be a box of grenades. Some have pins, some have triggers. These were triggered by heat, and luckily made a very distinctive crescendo in volume and pitch prior to detonation. Her brain told her to throw the box. She even pictured herself throwing the box, but instead she jumped backwards again. Why did she do this? Even while it was happening, it confused her, but she decided to stay with it. Time slowed, and for Kaya, very nearly stopped altogether. Her dad used to say that she was faster than a speeding bullet. In that frozen moment in the air, she recalled the many times when she had run the 200-meter race at track events, and she had always been mystified by the fact that when she was running, her legs seemed almost numb, her footfalls seeming dulled to her own sense of gravity. However, she nearly always won, as if her legs had a strange kind of mind of their own, but one as competitive as the rest of her. It seemed that another one of those moments was to be experienced now. In midair, without feeling a thing, Kaya brought her knees as close up to her chest as she could. Her armored knees coming into very brief contact with the transparasteel reflective supports that gave the box its shape. This caused the box to turn 90 degrees, so the top of the box was now directly facing towards the lone grouper, who had begun to retreat backwards in the direction of the doorway, his eyes fixed on the cargo crate. Kaya's knees now against her chest, almost touching her chin, she kicked with all her might, again hitting and sliding on the hard ground, clearing the blast radius by a matter of inches. Thanks to the amount of damage done to the crate by the previous blaster fire, the panel lid that kept the cargo secure fell from its mountings, spilling the grenades in the grouper's direction. The heat from the bolts had set off a chain reaction, and the grenades exploded. Time seemed to return to a regular pace. Kaya rose up slowly on her back. She pulled the goggles she had placed on her forehead after taking cover down from her eyes, activating them. There were no life signs in the immediate area. Kaya took a deep breath, putting a finger to her ear. "Doc," she breathed. "What the hell just happened?" There was a long pause, and then the radio crackled in her ear.
"You asked what I prescribed and administered at the hospital. Now you know."
"What the fuck did you do to me?"
"I injected you with a healing mixture consisting of elements with long, impronounceable names. But to cut a long story short, a cocktail of rejuvenation remedies native to Aquitania, and a few physical and cognitive augmentation formulas consisting of self-replicating and perpetuating nanotechnology of my own design."
Kaya again began to make her way in the direction of the cargo bay. She was about to respond when the doc cut her off.
"Darling, you've got more groupers heading your way. No doubt those close-range grenades caused quite a bang."
"Which way do I go?" She focused her mind on what she could see, looking past the smoke and fire created by the explosion. She spotted a left-hand turning into what looked like a narrower corridor. The radio crackled in response, but this time Kaya cut Grayson off. "Never mind.
She realized as she came face to face with their newly found passage, deciding laterally on the way to grab one of the group's blaster rifles and secure it round her shoulder, that there was only a warped panel blocking her way. Urgently, she kicked it inwards, climbing inside and repositioning it in the most natural way she could. She looked ahead of her. It seemed she had found herself in some kind of long, narrow shaft. It had looked bigger through the walls and the goggles. "I think I've found some kind of ventilation shaft," Kaya said, touching her ear.
"Won't be much ventilation in there. Switch to your independent supply and close the external air vents. It will use more energy, but won't unknowingly be breathing in the tasteless, near-odorless fumes that the freighter drones use for airlock sanitation."
"I'll keep that in mind," Kaya said, using one of the minuscule dials on her wrist to close off the oxygen in filters and activating the mask's independent supply.
"Anything else you want to tell me?"
The radio crackled.
"Such as?"
"Such as why the hell you thought you had the right to administer a life-changing dose of super juice without consulting me first?" There was a long pause. No crackle sounded in Kaya's ear.
"Doc, you there? Answer me."
Finally, after another pause, the radio crackled.
"If you want an answer, why don't you ask your brother Ezra?"
In the airlock shaft, Kaya froze. "What? Ezra? What the hell would he know about all this?"
"A surprising amount, you may or may not be surprised to learn. But you have to pick your battles. Wait for the opportune moment."
And when's that? Ahead, there was a clap of thunder. The hissing sound of swirling rain increasing in earnest. A distant sound of periodic blaster fire. The radio sounded in Kaya's ear.
"Unfortunately, not right now."
Kaya grunted in utter frustration, but knew she had to focus. What was going on right now was too bizarre to not be absolutely and utterly real, and she knew that she had more important and immediate things on which to focus. "Which route are you taking?"
"The high road."
"What if I wanted to take the high road?"
"Are we talking literally or metaphorically?"
"You know what I mean."
"Let's just say the climb would take too long."
"How come?"
"Because defying gravity isn't exactly in your current repertoire."
"Wait. Are you saying you can fucking fly?"
"It's a long story."
"And all I got was better reflexes? That's kinda boring. Not to sound ungrateful or anything." On the other end of the radio, Grayson sighed.
"Trust me, love. You don't want what I am. Now hurry up. We're running out of time. I've managed to secure the stabilizers for now, but they won't hold."
"What about the Taurus? I still can't believe the engines are strong enough to support this whole freighter, not to mention the weight distribution."
"Again, it's a long story. There's a limit on that too."
"I guess there's a fucking limit. How long?" There was a pause.
"Another 6.5 minutes. Then we going down. And it looks like our premature party crashers made it into the freighter's cargo bay. But the crew are, let's say, less than happy."
"No shit. What are we gonna do?
Play some bets?"
"You're kidding, right? Didn't you used to work with these people?"
"You like everyone you ever worked with?"
"Unless they pissed me off on a regular basis, then yeah, I guess." "Did one of them piss you off?"
"He might have."
"Oh, so it's a guy. What about the other one? Another guy? Girl? Asexual Cyclops?"
"Now, why would you go to Asexual Cyclops as your third option?"
"Don't judge me."
"I'll do my best."
"Are you also gonna do your best to help your friends?"
"They're not my..."
Kaya cut him off. "Bullshit, they're your friends. If they weren't your friends, I doubt we'd have decided to come on board. You were concerned for their well-being. Admit it." A longer pause. On the other end of the line, Grayson considered. There were so many retorts he could utter in response to that taunt. So many answers he could give. But the less confused and more sure of herself Kaya was, the more Grayson believed she was likely to succeed. And so, Grayson relented.
"Fine. I'm assuming you picked up a rifle from one of your encounter with the groupers."
"How did you know that?"
"Did you or did you not pick up a rifle?"
"I did."
"Then that's all that matters. Just listen. Here's the plan."
5. The freighter's hangar bay looked like it had been hit by a tornado filled with razor-sharp glass. Dried, eroding specks of once molten rock now spread to ash, staining every inch of the floors and walls. The center of the storm was vast and fast approaching. It was clear to the captain, the lieutenant, the doctor, and even Kaya that the remaining crew of the cargo freighter and the remaining groupers who had accompanied them had given up all hope of regaining attitude control of the ship and abandoned all attempts at evacuation. The ship was just floating inexorably towards the heart of the atmospheric storm. at the center of which there would be no breathable air, and the lightning strikes or the prolonged exposure to the undiluted acidic rain would surely finish them off if suffocation or extreme momentum did not. Kaya had emerged moments earlier at the rear of the cargo bay. Upon her emergence, she had requested that the doctor activate his signal beacon temporarily. Not so long that anyone in the bay scanning would pick up a signal, but long enough that Kaya could work out where best to position herself. Grayson had taken the high road, as he had referred to it, and so had a bird's eye view from the upper bay platforms of the points of interest below, consisting of, according to Grayson's report, a large hole in the starboard bay wall that was once the starboard observation viewing platform, with a large scimitar-shaped starship sticking out of it, upside down, burning, the gash in the porthole extending past the viewing platform, over 80 to 100 feet wide, around the width of the daemon, or thereabouts. Near the front of the bay, beyond which lay the disintegrating hangar entrance, now sealed off by a force field almost as glitchy as the ones housed in the daemon, creating periodic airlock failures that caused those maintaining the shield gate to be consistently unsteady on their feet. A small crowd of crew members, all masked probably due to the unstable air supply, gathered uncertainly yet aggressively around two bound individuals, kicking and slapping at them with brute force and malice. Kaya, who was surprised to see the two victims of the mob mostly taking the punishment being dealt out to them, had managed to position herself at the near diagonal opposite point of the bay and had a clear view of the gaggle of thugs.
"Get their masks off,"
she heard one snarl.
"Leave the masks. Take the head."
An infectious laugh traveled around the wall of meat created by the freighter thugs. More kicks and punches sounded. This time Kaya did hear cries of pain. They were muffled due to the distance and whatever internal mechanism the bound mercenaries used to disguise their voices, but she could tell that they were nearing the end of their rope. The wrecked scimitar to Kaya's 3 o'clock caught her eye. Briefly, she started to consider how the hell either of them could have survived a crash like that that would wreck a ship like this. Like, well, that. All the thises and thats buzzing around her head were confusing her, and so she looked away and refocused. In the space of half a minute, Kaya had removed a flat-pack rifle scope from one of the compartments in her armor, put it together, and attached it to her new liberated rifle. She peeked through the sights, goggles round her neck, the overlay of the rifle sight similar to the one she had on display on the Taurus, but not as advanced. She was obscured by a toppled pile of crates and an upturned repulsor vehicle. Pointing the barrel of the rifle gently through the gap at the midpoint of the debris, she searched slowly for the most practical and effective shot. In her head, she began to hum. Quietly. The comlink crackled in her ear.
"Are you ready?"
"Bitch, I was ready yesterday."
"I don't doubt that for a second. What can you see?"
"I can see they still haven't managed to remove their helmets. What are those things even made of?"
"Not important,"
snapped Grayson. "Right, right," she paused, collecting her sights, gathering her oxygen. "I can see a few grunts doing some kicking, bunch of groupers guarding the engineers at the gate, and..." She paused again. "What the hell is that?" Her sights passed over a near-transparent crate, about the size of the one she had lifted earlier, but whatever was seemingly suspended in the middle of it definitely didn't seem like a grenade. It seemed more like a small jewel, like some kind of ruby or crystal. It glowed brightly and ominously, bathing anyone who passed by it or stood to stare at it in a strange red gleam that made Kaya feel cold from the inside out.
"That," Grayson said, "is nothing you need to worry about right now. Focus on the prisoners, and whatever you do, do not hit that crate. You copy?"
"Copy," Kaya said, placing an all too steady finger upon the rifle's trigger.
Ladies and gentlemen, hybrids, drones, and variations thereupon, I'd like to apologize personally for all of this confusion and vile disruption. A few hours ago, before being caught in this intolerable storm, one that I at least hope will be remembered even if we, or rather you, are not. Many people who were once a part of this great crew have died today, died defending themselves from an ambush." Here, the speaker paused, gesturing with an oversized arm for three of the grunts to reposition the prisoners so the growing audience could get a better view. It took two of the grunts to shunt the captain around in stages. "An ambush committed by this abomination."
Here, the speaker grabbed the captain's shoulder, raising him slightly, with one arm for emphasis and probably to show that his size projected strength instead of weakness.
Captain Arkham Void.
On the other side of the cargo bay, unmoving, Kaya mouthed the name to herself, feeling herself frown deeply. Again, she focused her mind.
A once great and once seemingly unique addition to a variety of Akatanian factions, mostly, of course, concerning mystical and biological espionage, something that we guild members cannot abide unless in the seat of ultimate approval. These are longer, harder, more uncertain cycles, my dear friends and comrades. Through me, today, the Guild of Vandalore takes action against the High Council. Disgraced operative, or no. And of course, here the enormous figure made his way over to the lieutenant, presenting her in the same way she had the captain. Arkham. The man continued. Let us not forget the captain's newest fan, latest lieutenant, just soon to be his late lieutenant. In a move that seemed far too fast for a man of his size, he struck her in the side with his foot, making her buckle and cough. There was blood trickling out of the gas positioned on the left side of her skull. She was lucky to be alive. The lieutenant knew that. Kaya could tell. Kaya could also tell that there was something less human about the captain in comparison to the lieutenant. Maybe it was due to the lieutenant's more weakened state. The captain didn't seem to have a head injury, or at least, not one severe enough that it was outwardly showing.
If I'm honest with you, everyone, the name of this treacherous new biggest fan escapes me at the moment. I suppose that'll make it easier for her to be erased from history.
The large being smiled maliciously. Suddenly, the lieutenant's head snapped upright, and even though, from where Kai was positioned, she couldn't see any discernible eyes behind the helmet, she could tell that the lieutenant's gaze had captivated the jesting executioner more than he was expecting. The lieutenant spoke. Her voice changer was malfunctioning, jumping around the lower voice register like a lazy pinball.
You know absolutely nothing about history, you ridiculous thing. The guild are finished. Where do you think your backup is? We didn't have time to take it out. And yet, they're still not here. What does that tell you? Actually, don't answer that. What it tells me is that either their forces are stretched so thin since Galen's total fuck-up that they weren't able to spare any extra gunships or any cruiser to take you guys in tow.
Then the captain spoke.
Either that, or they just don't care.
The lieutenant nodded slowly, sleepily in agreement, glancing at the large man whose smile disappeared. He remained silent.
Either way, you're screwed.
The captain grunted in giggling agreement.
Totally screwed.
Silence.
The speaker struck them both again, one after the other with queer force. It seemed he had heard enough. The man's smile returned.
They may be screwed, as you put it. And you definitely are, but I am not. As an honored guild commander, I have a personal escape route.
You really think that piece of crap has enough power to reassemble all of those atoms of yours? That's a lot of ground to cover.
Jeered the captain, receiving another blow in response. Kaya heard this and had to resist the urge to chuckle. But what she also noticed is that the rest of the crowd also heard the guild commander's remark about his emergency escape. The jeering that had sounded all through the man's speech so far had been in his favor, but now the atmosphere was different. The crowd seemed spurred on by the fact that the ship seemed to be coming apart more and more. However, there were very few places around to escape to without convenience of teleportation, given all the escape pods had been jettisoned by the cowardly crew members or smart crew members who had chosen to immediately evacuate before the storm had taken hold. Kaya repositioned herself one final time, poised to fire. She had chosen her first three shots, what felt like hours ago, but she was waiting for the right time. The radio in her ear crackled as if on a cue.
Get ready,
Gryson said. The anticipation in his voice palpable.
You think installing me will save your life?
or the life of your precious girlfriend. The captain lowered his head slightly, in a gesture of seeming shame. Speak! By the directives, answer me! The captain grunted, again suppressing a giggle.
Nah, I didn't think I could save my ass, or hers, by insulting you. You're too sensitive for that. I'm just stalling.
Stalling? With that, the captain seemed to angle his head, seemingly staring into the near-middle distance, glancing up briefly, but staring almost diagonally across from where he had been kneeling, staring right at where Kaya was hidden. A signal seemed to pass to Kaya from Captain Arkham Void, a person that, as far as Kaya was presently concerned, she had never even met or even heard of before this bizarre day. And yet, it was a message that she understood. That message was also intercepted by the dock on the above platform, who proceeded to remotely detach the stabilizer support lines sourced from the Taurus, setting an interception course. The ship began to fall gradually as Kaya fired a double shot in quick succession, having manually targeted both sets of restraints, thankfully bound around the captain's and the lieutenant's front. The executioner pulled a large, ceremonial-looking knife from his robes and was making a plunge at the captain's chest just as his bonds were released. He caught the heavy arms of the heavy-set monster man, kicking and striking him with his legs and head, avoiding the knife narrowly. The lieutenant too had broken free of her bonds thanks to Kaya's shot, and grabbing a deceased grouper's rifle, one not dissimilar from the one Kaya was holding, though minus a scope and making the choice to hold it with one hand, she drew one of her two katana-like blades from the left-hand sheath on her back, momentarily smirking under the helmet at the fact that none of the crew members had been able to remove either her weapons or helmet from the positions they were fixed in. It seemed that some of the improvements that she had made to Acatanian tech had paid off after all. Grison decided to make his grand, spark-filled entrance when he noticed the remaining members of the crowd attempt to open fire on the lieutenant, who had her back to the crowd of the grunts, thanks to the groupers beyond, guarding the cargo bay's laser gate. Purplish-blue sparks flew from his hands and fingers in a specifically directed arc that had a chain effect on all the enemies in close proximity to it. One by one, sometimes two by two, grunts fell. Certain reactive metals around the bay caused the sparks to increase in intensity, creating enough of a distraction for Kaya to change position.
Go, go, go!
The doctor prompted, launching an electrified fist into the face of another freighter thug, and then drawing a sword of his own, seemingly out of nowhere. Kaya had by now dumped the rifle, and was now dual-wielding both of her blasters, opening rapid fire at the gaggle of groupers who were attempting to stop the remaining engineers from retreating. One went down, then another. Kaya closed the gap in seconds between herself and the lieutenant, who, despite the face covering, used positive body language to convey her appreciation. For a split second, Kaya was so caught up in the way the lieutenant moved that she didn't see a partially obscured grouper take aim and fire, catching the edge of the battery pack on Kaya's right-hand blaster. The heat from the bolt too much for the battery pack to cool naturally, thanks to the added heat from recent use. Kaya dropped it with a slight yelp, simultaneously hitting the deck as the thing exploded. Before the grouper could reload, however, the lieutenant turned and let a katana fly from her hand, in a maneuver not entirely dissimilar from the one Kaya had performed in the corridor not long before. The grouper's body thwacked against the laser gate, setting the plastic armor alight in mere seconds and incinerating him entirely. Kaya stared up from where she lay, trying to make sense of what she was looking at. There was something on the edge of her mind, bothering her to an irrational degree, but she couldn't seem to put a finger on it. She shook her head as she righted herself, rising up slowly, pleased to see the only enemy forces remaining consisted of three remaining groupers being electrocuted and the giant horrible blue monster man who had been droning on about things only part of Kaya understood. He was no match for the captain when unbound, of course. Kaya was watching him be lowered to his knees, regarded his reactions to whispered threats she couldn't quite hear, relishing in his pain a little too much. The old blue man was noticeably aged and extremely, almost obscenely large-framed. His skin was as blue as a piercing summer sky, one too hot and claustrophobic to be enjoyable. His eyes were languid and strained, now widening with an inner crescendo of fear that wouldn't quiet down. Dirty, pus-yellow eyes with stone-like pupils and rotting teeth that put Kaya in mind of melting wax fruit. Fruit now bleeding and dying. Kaya was snapped out of her trance when there was a hand placed over her shoulder. She turned to see the masked woman standing before her. The increasingly more sickening and blood-curdling sounds of the Guild Commander's death was not enough to make her turn around.
The female mercenary was taller than Kaya, and had a much wider shoulder frame. The way she tilted her head to one side when she looked down at her gave Kaya pause. But again, she didn't know why.
"Are you all right?" Kaya asked.
"I've been better. But I'm not dead.
And he isn't either." She nodded at the captain. Her captain.
"Thanks to you."
"Don't thank me yet," Kaya said, almost instinctively. "First, we have to get out of here."
"Come on, then," said the doc, sauntering over in the direction of his comrades. The lieutenant gazed.
"Gray, is that you?"
Grayson smiled. "The doctor will see you now."
"Oh my god, you made it! I can't believe it! You made it! Arkham, look!"
The lieutenant pawed at Grayson as she spoke.
"He's not dead!"
Arkham Void took a deep breath before he spoke.
"It seems he isn't, but that'll change if we don't move. Now!"
He glanced at Grayson, only making partial eye contact.
"It's good to see you, Doc."
With that, Arkham began to make for the cargo bay's exit. "You too, Captain," Grayson said. The Doc too made for the exit, leaving Kaya and the Lieutenant standing together. "What's the deal with those two?" Kaya asked.
"It's a long story."
Then, changing the subject, the Lieutenant added, with a flourish of a movement,
"Here, take this blade. Use it for close range if you need. I've got another one. In this life, one gun is never enough."
The Lieutenant too then made for the exit, breaking into a jog to perhaps convey urgency. Even so, Kaya stood there for a further couple of seconds, smiling curiously at the mysterious, sauntering woman. "What's your name?" Kaya asked, placing the magnetized sheath behind her comfortably, and then activating the clamps. It hung off of her effortlessly. The Lieutenant didn't answer the question right away. Instead, she turned to Kaya as she walked.
"You can call me Dee."
The final blurred moments of the mission had come in the form of another near miss. The journey from the cargo bay was fraught with missteps and route changes, and although it didn't take them as long to get out as it did to get in, it still took them long enough for reinforcements to arrive. A small dropship housing more groupers and two gunships almost twice the size of the Taurus was waiting for them. Luckily, thanks to the Scimitar-class auto-tracking interception system, run by House, of course, all they had to worry about was making sure they didn't miss the jump from the freighter to the Taurus as it passed by at speed. All was well until Dee took a blaster bolt to the shoulder and Arkham got knocked over the edge, luckily being able to get hold of a protruding sensor array that very nearly snapped under his weight. Taking it in turns to enter the Taurus ended up being the final course of action to complete their escape. First, Kaya, after spending a full minute deflecting blaster bolts with her new Akatanian silver blade and returning blaster bolts of her own, giving Grayson enough space to slow the Taurus, at least enough for Kaya to enter through the opening landing bay doors as the ship seemingly moved at the speed of thought. Kaya managed to climb her way into the cockpit seat and take manual control of the Taurus, getting House to auto-target one of the remaining gunships in order to focus on the flight controls.
"Is Dee okay?" Kaya asked into the radio. Still hanging from the bendy array, Arkham answered.
"She's down, but she's okay. Gry's got her back."
Kaya heard Arkham pull himself up back onto the roof of the descending ship. He pulled out two of his own blaster bolt guns and began firing at the remaining groupers exiting the garrison pod, fired by the one remaining dropship. Some fired clumsily, others weren't far off target. One was so near its target that it could have made a hole in Arkham's head if he had been any closer to the source of the shot. The bolt hit him square in the forehead, knocking him out. Grayson reported Arkham's condition, instructing Kaya to lock on an ion cannon blast and take out the remaining gunship. Grayson used his manipulable energy to enhance the ion blast, causing the ship's core to ignite and implode. With his thoughts and prayers to the presiders and the directives of old, Dr. Grayson Wolf lifted both the captain and the lieutenant into the air, not with his arms, but with his mind. On her final pass, Kaya let fly another barrage of scimitar blaster fire, deterring the remaining groupers from taking any further steps. Kaya drew the ship parallel with Grayson and the others. On the monitors, she saw him holding them, both suspended and unconscious in midair, almost floating himself in what Kaya seemed to perceive as some kind of protective force field or something similar. Regardless of her curiosity in relation to Grayson's abilities, Kaya shouted into the radio.
"Are they on board yet?"
"No, not yet."
"Well, fucking get them on board!"
Just under 15 seconds later, Kaya heard the cargo bay doors open and close.
No commotion, just heavy breathing, and three simple words. Punch it, Kaya. And with that, the Taurus ascended out of the storm and into the cold.
If you're a podcast clown like I am, you must have dreamed about starting your own. Let me tell you, my dreadful darlings, it's never easy, but it's one of the best decisions I ever made. It was either that or waste away in my own subjective ascendance. Of course, it can be more than just a little overwhelming to know how to get started. Buzzsprout can help you launch your podcast professionally and in style, linking you with all of the major podcasting platforms such as Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and much, much more. Join us up in the buzzing, sprouting podcast cloud to breathe in the renowned analytical sound of the accurate analysis and promotion tools provided. Follow the link in the show notes below to start your journey and receive a $20 Amazon gift card. We're waiting for you. Buzzsprout, the best and excitingly prettiest way to start a podcast.